Usually when we talk about digital security, we tend to borrow concepts from physical security. Like, you build a strong high wall around your network.
Right.
You put heavy locks on the front doors. You station guards to check the IDs of absolutely everyone trying to get inside. I mean, the entire philosophy is built around a single comforting idea: keeping the bad guys out.
Yeah, it's a classic perimeter defense mindset. We naturally want to draw that line in the sand. We tell ourselves that we can trust everything that lives inside the house, and well, we just have to aggressively scrutinize anything lurking outside.
But what happens when that mental model just completely breaks down? Like, what happens when the threat isn't trying to smash a window or pick a lock? What if the attacker is already sitting comfortably inside your house, hiding inside the very things you brought in yourself?
That is the nightmare scenario.
Exactly. So, welcome, learner, to today's custom-tailored deep dive briefing. Today, we're bringing you a rapid-fire, three-part cybersecurity briefing focused on, well, practical impact and clear takeaways from the top three threat reports crossing our desks right now.
And our unifying theme for this briefing is the hidden dangers inside the digital tools we blindly trust.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are looking at some incredibly sophisticated evasion tactics today.
We really are. I mean, in modern cybersecurity, the most fascinating element isn't just what attackers steal anymore, it's where they hide.
Right.
And we're looking at three distinct stories today that highlight this perfectly. We are going to explore malicious code hiding in the seemingly harmless fonts your web browser downloads, and advanced persistent threat hiding their communications in completely legitimate cloud services, and a critical flaw hiding deep inside the foundational code of tools we use every single day.
It's basically the digital equivalent of a Trojan horse. But, instead of a giant wooden statue sitting outside the city gates, it's an everyday tool, like a browser ad blocker, or a font file rendering text on a screen, or even a simple outbound network request that you just assume is safe.
Exactly.
So let's jump right into our first story. Microsoft just published a major technical report, and it details the removal of 119 extensions from their Edge browser web store.
Right. And we are talking about ad blockers, VPNs, web translators, video downloaders.
Yeah, the exact kinds of utilities you might install without a second thought because, well, they actually do what they advertise.
Yeah, that functionality is a core part of the illusion. I mean, these extensions earned legitimate user reviews because the surface level features worked flawlessly. Like, if you downloaded a translator, it translated your pages.
But underneath that utility, they were harboring a massive coordinated malware operation. Microsoft refers to this campaign as DagoAd. And their telemetry estimates that these 119 extensions had a combined install ceiling of up to 2.6 million users.
That's a massive footprint.
Up to 2.6 million users. And they stress that this is a ceiling, not a confirmed list of compromised victims, because this particular malware was incredibly patient. It didn't just install itself and immediately start reading your hard drive. It waited in the shadows.
What's fascinating here is the sheer level of tradecraft the attackers use to stay hidden, specifically a technique called steganography.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. So for those unfamiliar, steganography is the ancient practice of concealing a file or a message or an image within another file.
Like invisible ink, sort of?
Yeah, exactly, but digitally.
Okay.
So it's different from encryption, right? Encryption scrambles a message so you can't read it. Steganography hides the fact that a message even exists in the first place.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So in the early days of this campaign, the attackers took standard PNG image files. Think of the little graphical icon that shows up next to your browser's address bar.
Right, the extension icon.
Yeah. And they appended executable JavaScript right after the IEND marker of the image code.
The IEND marker. That's essentially the digital period at the end of the image's sentence, right? Telling the computer to stop reading.
Exactly.
So the image renders perfectly fine. You look at it, the browser looks at it, and it just registers as a normal picture of a puzzle piece or a shield or whatever. But hanging silently off the back of it is a malicious script.
Yeah, and that is the exact blind spot they exploited. Because static security scanners typically look at the file header, they see it's a valid PNG image, they verify the image data, and they just move on.
Right, they don't look past the period.
Exactly. But as those detection tools eventually got smarter and started checking the ends of files, the attackers evolved. They moved their payloads from PNGs to WebP images, and then, brilliantly, to WOFF2 font files.
Wait, fonts? Like the actual text styling file?
Yeah. They started hiding their malicious code inside the font's metadata, or even woven into the specific data ranges used to render Asian text glyphs.
Wow. I mean, imagine you are receiving a delivery. It's like a smuggler hollowing out the tires of a perfectly normal-looking delivery truck. The truck still drives up to your house and delivers your packages on time, so you never have any reason to go out and inspect the rubber on the tires.
That analogy captures the deception perfectly. And, you know, the attackers were just as careful about when they allowed that hidden code to execute.
Right, they didn't want to make noise.
Exactly. The malware had a multi-day delay built in, ensuring it didn't do anything suspicious immediately after installation. And it also utilized a 10% execution gate.
Meaning it would only ever activate on a small fraction of the infected machines, right?
Wait.
Keeping the overall noise level low so security vendors wouldn't notice a massive spike in strange behavior.
Yes.
But honestly, my favorite detail from the report is how it watched the user.
Mm.
Like the report says, it actively monitored the browser to see if he had the developer tools open. I mean, how does a hidden script inside a font file even know if I'm looking for it?
It's pretty clever. It uses built-in browser APIs to check your screen's real estate. So if the JavaScript detects that the inner window dimension of your browser suddenly shrinks while the outer dimension stays the same.
Oh, because a side panel just popped up.
Right. It infers that a panel like the developer tools just snapped open. It can also detect if the browser's debugger function is paused. And if it syncs as an analyst or just a curious user trying to look under the hood, the malware instantly halts its routine and just goes back to sleep.
It is actively watching you to see if you are watching it.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. So, okay, let's say the coast is clear, the delay timer is finished, and it finally wakes up. What happens next?
Well, it behaves like a two-faced coin. The surface-level operation is widespread ad fraud, so it invisibly injects ads into your browsing sessions. It hijacks affiliate commissions on massive e-commerce sites like Amazon, eBay, AliExpress, and it redirects your search engine queries.
Okay, so it's a moneymaker. Yeah, that mechanism constantly skims money for the attackers, but it generates network noise. The truly devastating damage happens underneath. The secondary payload includes a remote code execution backdoor.
Out.
Yeah. Microsoft observed it actively stealing Google credentials and second-factor codes right as users typed them at the sign-in screen. It harvested WordPress admin logins, and it exfiltrated bulk cookies for session hijacking.
And let's emphasize why that last part is so dangerous for you, the listener. If they steal your active session cookie, they don't even need your password.
Yeah.
To the website, they just become you.
Exactly.
And Microsoft found they were using Google Analytics tracking IDs as covert telemetry to monitor their own campaign. They essentially built a real-time command dashboard using Google's own legitimate infrastructure to track their infections.
The operation just displays remarkable sophistication. I mean, the attackers proxied their command traffic through Cloudflare workers, they abused GitHub pages to host payloads, and they maintained over 10 command and control domains with automatic failover in case one got blocked.
Okay, so who is pulling the strings here? I know Microsoft hasn't officially named the actor, but the security firm, Koi Security, connects this infrastructure to a Chinese operation they call Dark Spectre.
Yes, they noted that the credential stealing payload sends data to a specific domain, myarchive.info, which has historical ties to Dark Spectre.
Right. And it also perfectly matches the tactics of a previous campaign called Ghost Poster. You know, right down to hiding code inside the extension's icon and reusing extension names like Ads Block Ultimate. But just to be clear to the listener, we are just reporting the forensic findings from the researchers here, not making our own attributions.
Absolutely. The forensic overlap is compelling, though, and the operators are reportedly still active, continuously tweaking their code to evade new detections.
Which brings us to the practical impact for you. After this briefing, open your Edge browser and type edge.extensions into the address bar. Microsoft's technical report has the full list of the 119 bad extension IDs.
And if you have a match, or if Edge already removed one automatically with a warning banner, you need to assume your entire browser environment was compromised.
Yes. Change your passwords for Google, WordPress, banking, anything sensitive. And please upgrade to a hardware security key. SMS, text message, two-factor authentication will not protect you against this level of cookie and session theft. But a physical hardware key will stop them in their tracks.
That is crucial advice to follow. Session theft bypasses almost all standard forms of multi-factor authentication.
So StegoAd was hiding its command and control servers using services like Cloudflare and GitHub. Our next threat actor has taken that concept and made abusing legitimate cloud platforms their entire operational strategy.
Oh, yeah.
We're moving from hidden code in browser extensions to hidden communications in the cloud itself.
We are diving into a comprehensive report from the Slovakian cybersecurity company ESET. They have been closely tracking a Russian advanced persistent threat group known as Gamaradon. According to ESET's telemetry, throughout the second half of 2025, Gamaradon mounted 35 distinct spear phishing campaigns, primarily targeting Ukrainian governmental and military institutions.
And ESET points out that their primary goal appears to be espionage, you know, covertly exfiltrating sensitive data to support Russian interests in the ongoing war. So if these are high-value military targets, how are they getting their foot in the door?
Well, the initial entry vector relies on classic spear phishing emails, but they utilize a modern evasion twist known as HTML smuggling.
Okay, walk us through how that actually looks to the person receiving the email.
Imagine you receive an email that looks like an urgent internal company memo. Attached is an HTML file. When you click it, your browser opens it like a normal web page.
Okay, pretty standard.
Right, but it doesn't download a piece of malware from a remote server. Instead, embedded inside that HTML file is a large scrambled blob of data and a small JavaScript snippet.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. When your browser renders the page, the JavaScript quietly unpacks that data blob and uses the browser's own internal mechanics to assemble a malicious file right there on your hard drive, completely offline.
Wow. Because the file didn't exist while it was traveling through the network, the corporate firewall and the email filters only saw harmless HTML text. They just let it sail right through.
That is the brilliant evasion of HTML smuggling. And in Gamaradon's case, the file they assemble is an HTA downloader.
HTA stands for HTML application, right?
Yes. And unlike a normal web page that runs in a restricted sandbox, Windows executes HTA files using a system tool that grants them much higher privileges to alter your computer.
Yikes.
From there, the attackers have been exploiting a recently patched vulnerability in the archiving software WinR, specifically CVE-2025-80088, to drop their malicious downloader directly into the Windows startup folder.
So now every single time the victim reboots their machine, the malware runs again. Okay, looking at the report's details on their toolset, I actually have a question. ESET mentions they use weaponizers like TerraLNK and an older script called Terrell Setup, specifically to infect USB thumb drives and network shared drives.
Right.
If they already have remote access to the computer via this phishing email, why on earth are they bothering with older tools to infect physical USB drives? That just feels like a step backward to me.
It might seem counterintuitive, yeah, but it addresses a critical concept called lateral movement. Securing a foothold on one computer is really just step one. In high security environments, like government ministries or military command centers, the most sensitive databases are deliberately air-gapped.
Ah, meaning those specific computers are physically disconnected from the internet and the broader corporate network.
Precisely. So if Gamaradon successfully infects an internet-connected receptionist computer, they still have no digital path to reach the classified database. However, if they silently infect a USB drive that gets plugged into that receptionist's computer, and later an employee unplugs that drive and walks it over to the air-gapped network to transfer a file,
boom, they cross the gap. The physical human becomes their network bridge.
Exactly.
Wow. The report notes that Terrell Setup scans for legitimate software installers on those USB drives and replaces them with self-extracting archives that contain both the real installer and the malware. That is deeply insidious. But, you know, what really caught my eye is how they handle their ongoing communications once they're actually inside.
Yeah, they deploy a new arsenal of PowerShell tools with names like Terra Effigy and Terrad. And what stands out is their significant reliance on third-party, completely mundane cloud services.
Right.
They're using platforms like Mastodon, Dropbox, Telegrad.ph, and even developer forums like Dev.to as digital dead drops.
Just like a spy in a movie leaving a chalk mark on a park bench to signal a handler.
It's the exact same principle. Instead of the infected computer reaching out to a suspicious IP address known to belong to hackers, it just navigates to a public Mastodon post or a DEV community page to read a seemingly random string of text.
And that text is actually an encrypted instruction telling the malware where the real hidden infrastructure is located for that specific day.
You got it.
And ESET noted a fascinating behavioral quirk in the telemetry, too. They observed the group taking distinct operational breaks that perfectly align with official Russian state holidays.
Yeah, which ESET suggests points heavily toward government-affiliated employees working a standard bureaucratic calendar.
Right, but again, we are just reporting ESET's forensic analysis on that point.
Yeah.
Let's talk about why this dead drop tactic is such a night and peel for the people trying to defend these networks.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this illustrates our theme of blind trust perfectly. I mean, blocking threats is incredibly difficult when the malware is communicating through the exact same legitimate cloud services your own company relies on to function every day.
Right, because if you tell your firewall to block all traffic to Dropbox or Mastodon, you might sever your own company's workflows or external communications.
Exactly. Gamma Ray doesn't need to punch a hole in your wall. They are hiding in the noise of everyday trusted internet traffic.
It's the ultimate camouflage. And, you know, that leads us perfectly into our third story, which flips the script entirely. With Gamma Ray, the victim has to actively open an email archive or plug in an infected USB drive.
Right.
But what if simply connecting outward to a server was enough to get compromised?
Oh, this is where we must discuss CVE-2026-55200. It is a critical vulnerability carrying a CVSS score of 9.2 out of 10.
And for context, CVSS is the industry standard scale for reading the severity of a vulnerability. And a 9.2 means this is a drop everything and patch it immediately level threat.
It really is. And this flaw exists in a deeply foundational library called libs2.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. When we think of hacking, we usually picture a hacker on the outside sending a malicious attack inward to a vulnerable corporate server,
right?
But libs2 is a client-side SSH library.
Yeah.
It is not the server. It is the tool running on your machine that reaches out to talk to a server.
The role reversal here is what makes it so dangerous. If a client device using a vulnerable version of libs2 connects to an SSH server that has been compromised or is intentionally set up by an attacker, that malicious server can actually attack the client.
Wow.
Yeah, no stolen credentials are required and no further user interaction is needed beyond initiating that initial outbound connection.
So the server basically answers the door and says, hello, nice to meet you. Here is a memory corruption exploit.
Uh-huh.
So how exactly does this bug work? Walk us through the mechanism under the hood.
Well, it comes down to a fundamental oversight in a function called slush2 transport thread. When the client and server are first shaking hands and setting up the secure connection, they send packets of data back and forth to establish the rules.
Right.
The server tells the client, hey, I'm about to send you a packet, and here is the mathematical packet length you need to prepare for.
Okay, that just sounds like standard networking.
It is, but the developers of libs2 only programmed the code to check if that length was less than 1. They never implemented a check to see if there is an upper limit.
Wait, really? No upper limit check at all?
None. Furthermore, the size calculation uses 32-bit arithmetic. So if a malicious server declares, my packet length is 0xFF, which translates to the absolute maximum possible 32-bit number.
Wait, I know this one. It's like an old car odometer maxed out at 999,999 miles. If you drive one more mile, it doesn't go to a million. It physically rolls over to all zeros.
That is exactly what an integer overflow is. When the code adds a few small padding values to that maximum number during its internal calculations, the number wraps around past zero.
Wow.
So to the computer's logic, that massive incoming payload suddenly looks like a tiny, tiny number.
Ah. So the system allocates a tiny little memory buffer, just a small physical space in RAM, to hold this incoming data.
And then the subsequent code takes the actual massive packet the server sent and writes it into that tiny buffer. The data spills over the edges, overwriting whatever critical information was sitting next to it in memory.
This is called an out-of-bounds heap, right?
Yes, and it's a classic textbook method for an attacker to inject their own instructions and achieve remote code execution on the client's machine.
Wait. Looking at my notes here, hasn't this exact library had a problem like this before?
Yeah.
I'm getting a massive sense of deja vu reading about an integer overflow in an SSH transport read.
Your memory is spot on. It is incredibly frustrating for defenders, but yes. 7 years ago, in 2019, they patched an almost identical class of bug in the exact same code area.
That's CVE-2019-3855, right?
Exactly. It highlights the tragedy of recurring flaws in legacy open source code that the entire internet infrastructure depends on.
And people do depend on it.
Yeah.
That is arguably the scariest part of this report. You don't usually go out and intentionally install libs2 on its own.
No, you don't.
It's baked into other tools. It's inside curl. It handles operations in Git, it's integrated into PHP, it runs in backup agents, and it's buried in the firmware updaters on random network appliances sitting in server racks.
Compounding the issue is that many of those tools use what we call statically linked libraries.
Okay, let's break that down for the listener. Why is a statically linked library so much worse in a crisis like this?
Think of a dynamically linked library as a shared public library in your town. If a book needs a correction, the town updates it once, and everyone who visits the library gets the correct information automatically when they check it out.
Right. So when your Linux operating system updates a dynamic library, every app uses the fixed version.
Exactly. But with static linking, a software developer takes a permanent snapshot of that library's code and bakes it directly into their specific application.
So it's completely isolated from the operating system's updates.
Yes. The only way to fix it is to wait for the vendor who makes that specific backup software or firmware to realize they have a problem, compile a brand new version of their entire product, and ship it to you.
Which means it becomes invisible technical debt.
Yeah.
I mean, you might have 10 different tools on your network harboring this vulnerability, and you wouldn't even know it.
Exactly. Now, context is critical regarding the immediate threat landscape. A security researcher named Tristan Madani discovered and reported this, and there is already a public proof of concept sitting in an archive on GitHub.
Oh, that's not good.
However, the author notes the exploit code is incomplete, and some of it was generated by AI fuzzing.
Okay, so it's not a turnkey point-and-click weapon that a novice can just use to take over the world this afternoon.
Not yet, no. And CISA, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, hasn't added it to their known exploited vulnerabilities catalog yet.
Right. So the blueprint is public, but widespread exploitation hasn't started. So here is your practical takeaway. Because there isn't a single universal patch you can download, you need to inventory everything in your environment that might bundle libs too.
Downstream projects like Debian are testing fixes now, actually.
Right. Until you could apply a patched build to your tools, you must strictly restrict outbound SSH connections to verified trusted servers. Watch your network telemetry for anomalies, like massive oversized packets or unexplained client application crashes.
Which are often the footprint of a failed memory exploit attempt.
Wow, okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground in this briefing. We started with StegoAdd, showing us how patient threat actors are hiding complex JavaScript malware inside the Asian text cliffs of browser font files.
Yeah, quietly watching our screens to evade security analysts before stealing our session cookies.
Then we analyzed Chimeridon. A stark reminder that advanced state-aligned hackers don't always need exotic custom infrastructure.
Right, they bypass network filters using HTML smuggling, they bridge air gaps with infected USB drives, and they hide their command instructions in the mundane noise of everyday Mastodon posts and Dropbox folders.
And finally, we looked at a 7-year-old ghost haunting the SSH tools we rely on daily, proving that sometimes the danger isn't who is trying to connect to you, but who you are blindly reaching out to connect with.
This raises an important question, learner. Information is only truly valuable when it is applied to your reality. As you go back to your day, look closely at your own software stack. Question the inherent trust you place in the tools that manage your network and the extensions that live in your browser. Are you assuming they are safe simply because they are familiar?
So what does this all mean for the future defense? We spend billions of dollars globally securing our perimeters. We buy next-generation firewalls. We mandate complex multi-factor authentication. We verify user identities relentlessly at the front door. But if a benign-looking font file, a random post on a developer forum, or a simple routine outbound Git fetch can completely bypass every single one of those walls, perhaps our fundamental definition of trusted traffic is entirely broken.
Yeah, that's a sobering thought.
Looking forward, do we need to abandon the perimeter mindset altogether and start treating our own outgoing requests as completely hostile? It is something to think about the next time you hit refresh. Thank you for joining us for this custom-tailored deep dive briefing. Stay curious and stay secure.